for joining us for this exceptional event. The library is able to host programs like this with the support of our members and friends. We thank you for your contributions, large or small, to our annual fund. Okay. Who likes secrets? Me too. Today, we're going to learn some secrets. Secrets about being a writer. I'm honored to introduce two beloved authors who will share their secrets about being writers today. Elizabeth Winthrop and Richard Peck. They are two very longtime members of our spectacular library. Between the two of them, they have been reading and writing at the Society Library for a combined total of 73 years. Elizabeth Winthrop is an award-winning writer of over 60 books for children and adults featuring unforgettable characters like Grace, William and Sir Simon, and last but certainly not least, Dumpy LaRue. Hailing from a family of writers, Elizabeth Winthrop has been a member of the Society Library since 1975. Richard Peck commenced his writing career in 1971, the day he left a teaching position at Hunter College High School. Since then, he has authored nearly 50 books and won numerous awards, including the Newbery Medal, the Margaret Edwards Award for Lifetime Achievement in Young Adult Literature, and the Edgar Mystery Award. He has twice been nominated for a National Book Award and has received a National Humanities Medal. The Best Man is his newest book, featuring Archer McGill, a boy on his way to being the best man he can be. It has received rave reviews and to date has been selected for 6 best of 2016 lists, including the New York Times and the New York Public Library. A lifelong reader, Richard Peck has been a member of the Society Library since 1984. We are thrilled to have both authors here today to share with all of us their tales of becoming and being a writer. Prepare yourself to learn the secrets and tips that are essential to the process for all who want to know, how do I become a writer?
Ladies and gentlemen, readers, we gather in one of our favorite places, the New York Society Library, the oldest library in New York, and older than the United States. Because it was founded in 1745, the year Elizabeth and I joined. And they've been serving readers ever since and harboring writers. Upstairs, there are cubicles where writers can write, like medieval monks hoping to illuminate their manuscripts. I don't write here. Do you?
I do.
You do. I can't write here because I can't carry my electric typewriter all the way from here. And I have to use an electric typewriter for several reasons, one of which is I never lost a young reader for electric typewriter. So, I'm up and down this open stacks, though, and I found novels in there that I was to write. I found letters from Civil War soldiers because I needed a voice for a Civil War novel called The River Between Us. I fall backwards with the books up there, panning for gold, trying to unlock the secrets of writers long dead. And I haunt the card catalog too downstairs, the last card catalog in the letters. And card catalogs never crash. My novels owe a great deal to this place because nobody that a reader ever became a writer. And you hope that every book beginning in the library will end there. A story is a secret shared. And Elizabeth and I are going to share some of our writing secrets with you, some novels. Two, in fact, important. So two secrets of how to build a book. How the story begins and who's going to tell it. I start at the beginning. And write page one, chapter one. On my page. It needs to be a page from the beginning. Never trust the screen. So I start writing as if I'm reading the book, not writing it. After all, I don't know what it's about, so I write it. And when I no longer read the page for directions, I retype that page. And when I retype it, I find three things I didn't catch earlier. It said that revising is so much easier on the computer. It's not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to hurt. Happy writing makes for sad people. So, when I can no longer read the page, I retype it. And then, when I get it just exactly the way I want it, I take out 20 words. You can get 20 words out of the tightest page you ever wrote, and sure. When you're young, you say, how long does it have to be? When you're old, you say, how short can I make? And I'm back and forth, weeks bleed into months. And I try to know what the ending is, but that's a snare and delusion. I was writing to a last line in this book, which was engraved on my heart. And then one day I came to it and put it in and gave it my editor. And she said, okay so far, but there's no ending. Would I have had to be in a book with no ending? Apparently I did. It wasn't the last line of the book. It was just the line I had fallen in love with. Usually you need to take out those lines entirely, but I'm not giving it up. It's the last line of the penultimate chapter, because there is a need for another chapter. Well, I had an unsuitable title, never mind what it was. I've often had 28 titles before I could find the right one. But I handed it in, and the editor said, title won't work. And I did what new then. I went to prom. I don't give it to you, of course. There's no place to hide now, is there? I don't get an email saying, title. And then one day, the big scary question, one was, I must have the title today because the art department requires it. Never mind about money, Jesus. And she said, if you don't come up with it, I will. She did. New York Times swallowed it whole. So I wouldn't have used this title if I thought of it, because it's a play by Gore Vidal. But she said, who cares? So, that was the easy way to get a title. And prom's not that expensive. And then we come to the importance. Well, I back and failed. And a year passes. A little longer than that for this one, because this is almost the first thing I have written about the 21st century. Not a place where I am much at home. And so I had a lot of trouble with the technology and what kids would have. You ask teachers what kids are doing with their phones, and they tell you one thing. You ask parents, and they tell you something completely different. So finally, I have to write fiction. I hope for the best. When I get to the end, see how the story finishes. Without rewriting it, I go back to the first chapter and go to writing. Now, I know now, am I ready to write the first chapter now that I know how it ends? Because the first chapter is the last chapter in disguise. And I've been warming up. And you can't warm up on young people's written time. So, that's what I do times 40. The most important rock lines you will write, apart from the title, and now you know you can get the end of your game. But you have to work very hard on getting the first line right. I never have the first line the first time. Sometimes I have 40 first lines. Sometimes it's later in my own work. And sometimes it is. I spend an hour a week in the bookstore copying out other people's opening lines. Just to give me some inspiration. Most of them are good books. You learn from the best. And we have editors now who don't look at good opening line from a bad one. So. And mine isn't quite that, but most are. So. You want an opening line that will grab the reader there. And I'm sorry, I keep an archive. I'm sorry to tell you that the best opening line in American English has already been written. And here it is. Where's Papa going with that ass?
Yes.
It's perfectly, it fits on one line. It doesn't need rhythm. It puts Papa and Axe on the same, sentence. It's perfect. You have to keep it up. And then, here's another one. Habit for a book that's done quite well. When my brother Jim was almost 13, he got his arm badly broken. It seemed to be a sleepy little southern town where nothing ever happened. Never start with setting. Our readers don't know Jim. And notice it didn't start with, I had a father named Atticus Finch, and he worshipped the ground he walked on. That's true, and that's what the novel's about, but it doesn't go in the first place. When he was nearly 13, my brother Jim got his arm back and broke at the hole. He's working with the specific and the auditory, you can hear it crying. And the precision of it, he was almost 13. That's the way to do it. Did she get it the first time out? I doubt it. She probably found it on page 6. I often find my titles on page 6. And that's fine. If you throw off the first 5, then you're working. But never settle for your first idea. It's no good. And then a more recent book by Carmen Agri-Dee called The Cheshire Cat. He was the best of Toms. He was the worst of Toms. I wish her well, but I wish I had fallen. So. Big secret number one is finding the opening line, and you'll have to look for it. And where did they come from? My last book, not the newest one, but the last one is called Nuss with the Question Mark Tail. And I found the opening for it on page 124 in the middle of a paragraph. What was I doing there? But yeah, I got it. And I put it on the front page and throughout the opening. Beginning. And it is, I share it with you. Every time a human walks out of a room, something with more feet walks in. That was a title that came to me after about 11 months of writing. Mice, of course, were only a whisker away and everywhere you failed to look. It's true of the room where you're sitting. It's truer still of Buckingham Palace. How busy the scampering world of mice within the palace walls through that mouse hole just behind the throne. How busy the royal meetings next door, where the royal carriages are kept in the royal houses had stabled beneath the clattering cobblestones of the royal mews, a whole private honeycomb of mouse passages crisscross and connect. One of them leads into the palace. That's a table of contents for the book. You can get into the palace if you're as small as a mouse. And whom would you wish to meet once you got there? The queen! And since it's 1897, it's Queen Victoria. When she's having a late night cup of tea, she lifts it off the saucer, and guess who's sitting in the saucer? So, but it's all anticipated. Did I know it when I first wrote it?
Of course not.
So, save your best efforts for the first chapter and write it last. Good titles are where you find them. I found one once on a visit to be the visiting author at a place called Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Now, if you're invited to a place called Grand Rapids, to Calvin. Calvin College, you know you're not going to have a good time. And indeed, I didn't. But I got a novel out of it, which is better. Calvin College does what every college ought to do. They bring in public school students, or grade school and junior high students from their area for a day of writing with an author. And then they identify the right kids, and the kids get to see their very handsome campus. So they said, you'll have eighth graders in the morning and seventh graders in the afternoon. 45 minutes with each group, teach them how to write. Well, I was a teacher. I know that in 45 minutes, a class period, you can only do one concept. So I do the big one. You are only as good as your opening line. Your opening line should be a grenade with the pin already pulled. However you want to say it. And I envisioned us sitting around the table and writing opening lines, and then making them better. There were 500 fifth graders in stadium seating. And I was holding my foot on a thrust stage. And there at the top were their teachers, already having asked if they had to stay for the program. And I just had one lesson plan, so you know what that means. And so I said, you are only as good as your opening line. 500 silent faces. I said, you will be rewarded if you have an opening line that interests your teacher. What interests a teacher? 500 silence. That's all I had. What interests a teacher? And finally, a voice there said, coffee. It's the longest morning of my life. Today in the afternoon, here came the seventh graders. And it was the same lesson plan, even more inappropriate for them. They came in, I was the only one in a room of 500 people not going through puberty. And I didn't know what interests a teacher. Well, the idea of entertaining a teacher loosed some naked hostility. These people are not to be entertained, they're to be brought down. There was much hair thrown among the girls. I don't do that part very well. So, what interests a teacher? Four times, and then a voice said, a breaking voice said, bravo.
Yes.
Put trouble in you. Well, I don't know if they believe me, but I do believe me. And I had been an opening line just to use with the sharing we didn't ever get to do. So important are opening lines that there is a prize called the Cuffy for the best opening line of the year. And I'm happy to tell you, I won it with my Grand Rapids for this book. If your teacher has to die, August isn't a bad time of year for it. standing ovation from fifth grade. But then I had to write a whole novel that went with it, and that's not the usual way, for me at least, but it was too good line not to use. And it won that prize. It also won a prize from the Catholic librarians. I've been trying to cater to Catholic librarians. I don't think I could have written that book, but see, you never know. Writing is, opening lines are important. Will you read yours, Elizabeth?
Oh, I'm terrified.
You seem all right to me.
Well, I want to just say that actually line, opening lines and voice sort of move together for me. So, in my case, I am not as stringent as Richard. I don't throw out my entire first chapter, but I take a very long time to get it right, and I cannot get it right until I have the voice. And this is a perfect example. This book, Counting on Grace, is about a little girl who is, this picture was taken by a famous child labor photographer named Lewis Hahn. I walked into a Vermont museum. I saw this picture. I did not know who she was. I did not want to know who she was. And I decided I would write a novel based on this little girl's face. So I did the research, and I figured she worked in a textile mill. She was a doffer, which means that you have to do off, take off the full bobbin here and replace it. Every minute that she is doing off the spinning, which working on the spinning frame, her mother is on what they call the loose pulley, which means that her mother is not paid. So can you imagine a child standing there working as fast as she can, and her mother is yelling at her, faster, Grace, faster. She's not being paid because Grace is paid for her. I made Grace left-handed. And I made Grace what we call in this day and age ADD. She could not concentrate, her feet moved when she talked, etc. Now, when I came to write the book, I'd done a lot of research. Like Richard, I haunt the rooms in this library. And what I do, which is terrible, is I fall completely in love with the research. And then I have to write the novel. And the thing about research and novels is that the research, the writer has to know the tip. The reader has to sense the iceberg. If you do it the other way around, the reader feels yelled at and talked down to. So I fell in love with the research, so I thought, okay, well, I'm going to write this third person, past tense. That didn't work. Then I decided I would write it half from Grace's voice and half from Lewis Hahn's voice. That didn't work. I wasn't getting anywhere. And finally, I thought, all right, I'm going to give this another try, and I am simply going to write a journal in Grace's voice. I'm just going to pretend to be Grace and write what it's like every day to go to this mill and to live with her family. And that was the voice. That's what worked. And I had never written a book. This is very interesting. I don't know about you, Richard. I had never written a book in first-person present tense. Which is really an immediate voice for readers right now. So my first line is tiny, but it is dialogue. And it is, Grace, your turn. So again, I probably wrote, Grace was sitting in the classroom, and the teacher was hanging and finally got to Grace, your turn, which I think drops you immediately into, it's not going to win any prizes. But it grabs the reader, and she goes on to say, the book is called The Red Badge of Courage. I like that name. I stand up to read, but as soon as I open my mouth, my feet start moving. It always happens that way. I can't help it. And so she's already immediately in trouble. You want the characters to get into trouble immediately. You do not want fiction to be a boy looking out the window considering the clouds in the sky. You do not, you know, exactly as Richard said, do a lot of setting, not a lot of description, grab them. Where's Papa going with that axe? I mean, that is, to my mind, the greatest.
And first person, that intensifies the immediate.
it doesn't mean you can't get incredibly close to your character in third person. It's just every book teaches you what that book's about. Somebody once said, I think it was Flannery O'Connor, I don't know what the book's about until I write it. And why write it if I do know it? There's no point to writing. And that was exactly what happened to me. With this book, a weird thing happened, not unlike with you. I got to the end of the book, I sent it to my editor. She said, that's great, we need a revision. Fine, I said, I love revising. It's not easy, but it's such a beautiful time of the book. And I read every book I write out loud. It's the only way I hear. I have a tendency, which I think many writers do, to word repeats. There'll be three justs on one page, two evens, or three alls. I'm in the middle of reading the book I've just finished to draft, so I'm very, very conscious of it. I read the book over, I revised it, I turned it in again, and was going to copy everything. And then I said, wait a minute, I cannot leave this girl in the dustbin this week. So I decided to go find her. Now Lewis Hine went into the spinning mill and couldn't hear her name because the spinning frame is so loud. And so her name was on a huge billboard with a picture, which I then discovered didn't have her name right. They never age right, didn't have her name right. And it was the mill had been turned into a Superfund site, so EPA thought of itself and put up a huge billboard for $1,800 saying, this is little 12-year-old Annie Laird. Her name was Addie Card. I found her. I met her grandchildren. She was dead. Nobody in the family knew that this picture has been on a Nike advertisement. It's been on a United States postage stamp, this little girl. And I said to her granddaughter, what did she die of? And she said, well, she died at 93 of lung cancer. And I said, well, probably the middle. She said, no, she smoked two packs. Well, trying to glorify her. But as a result, when I thought the book was over and the editor thought the book was over, I called her up and I said, the book is not over. It's not fair. So there's a whole epilogue about finding Addie and what it meant. Now, I had no idea that I thought, no, she's just an inspiration. And then it turned into a whole other thing that happened. And I actually had her name corrected in the U.S. Library Conference. They had her name on it. So books take you on. If you're a writer and you come to an empty page, you don't know where you're going. And you just get taken by the hand, by the character, and your journey.
And you give yourself permission to throw out most of it.
Exactly. And throw out so many words on the page. Tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter. But I do remember thinking, as a first novelist, how many pages should I make this book? Which I'm not going to do with writing. Exactly. And how long should it be? It's really how short can I make it. So.
Anything she says is right. We all go through the same thing. I read everything aloud because you're not writing about people sitting at a desk. You're writing about people at interacting. And so I look at different patterns. And you use different vocabulary. So that's an added tip. Yeah. I'm not going to read you your opening. My opening passage of The Best Man, we have heard in Elizabeth's, but I'm going to read you another important point, play at another important place in the novel, and that is the epiphany. We have a distinguished school librarian here today, Guy. Will you tell us the importance of the epiphany in fiction?
The epiphany in The Best Man?
Mm-hmm. No. Oh, I'm doing that. Generally. What is it?
A revelation of something.
or
yes.
Did you think of something in another book that I didn't write?
Well, there's an epiphany. You're putting on the spot.
Well, when Charlotte dies.
Well, when Wilbur realizes that Charlotte's going to die.
There you go.
Yes, it's the moment, a moment in the novel. I have two epiphanies in this one. One's on a Halloween party. I often have epiphanies at parties, I notice, because it gets everybody on the stage. But the first epiphany is important. I mean, it is something a boy learns he didn't know. And if we don't have those, we don't have a novel. Just as if we don't have conflict. I wanted to write a novel called The Best Man, but it had no villains in it. Everybody was going to act positive. Doesn't work. You can't go to an American school without confronting really bad people. and he is mugged in first grade. So I couldn't do that. Also, I wanted it to be blunt, but that didn't work. You often lose someone dear to you at that age, and so often a grandmother. And so that told itself. By the time you, after 8 months, for 8 months I put words in their mouths. They're my little puppets. And after 8 months, if there's no puppets, they have to go. But one morning you will wake up and you will hear voices. Not in the first month or maybe year. This is a story told by a boy. He's 11. And once the story told itself, it did what my boy stories always do. It's the relationship really between the father and the son. That's my favorite relationship. And so it is with this a quiet moment, but he's lost his. So he's lost one of his four male role models. The first death really is often a grandparent. And his uncle was a man of great dignity who taught him several things his father didn't teach. And you can see what they were. And also he was an avid Cubs fan, rabid Cubs fan. They all are. This follows his death. Dad, I said, do all grandpa's ashes have to go into the cemetery plot? We were stopped at a light. What do you have in mind? Dad said. I'm thinking maybe you and I and Uncle Paul could take a little bit of grandpa, maybe a handful, and scatter it on Ridley Field. He liked me, Mary, always did it. The light changed. Probably not legal, Dad said. No, I said that we could probably get away with it. Down in the garage, we shook about a tablespoon of ashes into an envelope. Dad sealed the flap with scotch tape and handed the envelope to me. No, he said. You and your Uncle Paul can take it from here. He screwed the lid back on the urn and left a half turn for me to do. Are we going to tell Grandma that Grandpa's not all here? You want a feller? Dad said. Not really, I said. Uncle Paul picked an away day for the Cubs for our visit. It was one of those days with the lake breeze rattling the ivy on the Ridley Field walls and summer slipping away. We came out of the dark into the concession area, and there it was. Blue sky, green infield, diamond opening like a fan. One of the perfect places on this earth. It was pretty much all ours, so nobody especially noticed when I leaned out of the stands and poured an envelope of something off the table. Play ball, Grandpa, I said, and we spoke. Now we were up in the center field bleachers on the scoreboard. We had on sunscreen and our Cubs caps. It's better without a game, Uncle Paul said, half asleep with his cap pulled down. I was a little groggy with the sun, but I said, should we be sad about Grandpa? No. We wouldn't want the life he had. also, I said, I think Dad wanted to give us a little time to talk. What about, do you suppose, Uncle Paul said. Search me, I said. Maybe he wanted us to talk about my teacher, Mr. Mavoy, being gay. Maybe your dad wants us to talk about me being gay, Uncle Paul said. Whoa. The sun stopped at the top of the sky. You knew I was gay, right? Uncle Paul got up, sat up, pushed his ball cap back. Sure, I said. I guess. Not really. No! Should we have talked this over before, Paul said, that your mom and dad are so not into pigeonholing people? Were we all being so liberal we left you out? Mr. Boyd told us about people who will wipe their tears on your face. That's good, Uncle Paul said. You have to be ready for people like that. My head was still kind of whirling. Grandpa, Dad, Uncle Paul, Mr. Boyd, those were the four I wanted to be. Uncle Paul, do you think I might be gay? I don't know, he said. Do you moisturize? What? Where do you stand on exfoliation? About sex? You didn't take that shirt yourself, did you tell me? Yeah. Uncle Paul, you're kidding me, right? I'm half kidding, he said. One more thing, then, I said. You love me, right? I love one man. I was inspired to the moisturizing by Mr. John Bates in your father. He's here today. Takes a little leash to write my books. That scene, the son of that scene, is inspired by George Will, another Illinois author like me, who wrote a wonderful little book called A Nice Little Place on the North Side. It's the history of Reedfield. This is the first novel I ever wrote on the basis of legislation. Who knew? But I began it on June 14th, 2016, the day same-sex marriage was implemented in my home state, Illinois. And before I could get the novel done, it was the law of the land. And then I thought, what? Are there people hearing about this at school? Great school. We always get the two and two late, and then other people do our jobs. Do they know that in America, marriage is everyone's right? It's nothing the textbook and will not be in my life. And it's not on the standardized test that rules the rules. So, but history has happened, and attention. Elizabeth and I are both fueled by history, coming from races set in 1910. Yes, I'm happier in the past, and I love teaching old history in books because I'm not so sure what they're learning in school about history and how it's still happening. And after all, I've fell in love with history in the past, not in school, but within the pages of The Badge of Courage and Gone with the Wind, a novel that could not be published today. But I read it in three or times. But then all novels are historical novels before they've been destroyed, and that was done with your favorite readers were born in the 21st century and will still be here in New York in the 22nd.
Are there any questions for the authors? Yes?
Richard, this may be trivia, but did I hear you say that you write with a different voice when you stand up?
Yeah.
Could you expand on that?
Yes, it's more conversational. And less passive. When you're sitting down, you're too comfortable. When you're standing up, you're energized by the cocktail party or making a speech or being called on the time to stand up. And, it's got more energy. And you can see it when you rewrite and revise that line. That line's moving in his arm. Another thing we didn't touch on, and it's part of it, in answer to that, and that is you read each sentence to see if it scans. Prose owes a lot to poetry, and there is no poetry in some writers' souls. That's a problem because I don't know how you get it, but you better have it. And you better look at a line and say, that line's droopy, and usually you know what it is, it's too long. If you're writing standing up, the sentences are short, too. That's all you get. I get two sentences in my first line.
And you use your hands when you're reading out loud.
Yes.
It's like a theatrical.
Yes. Like people walking down the street on a cell phone. Who's that for?
This is also with the reading out loud. So both of you, or Richard, when you're standing up, how are you standing up? I'm trying to think, where am I going to stand up? I'll stand. Do you have a podium?
I just wander around my room at home. Another reason I don't think I should be writing in this way. Yeah.
And Elizabeth, when you read aloud, do you read 10 pages?
I'm holding a page. And I walk by and I put that one down and I pick this one up.
So I've been too sedentary.
Yes. It's so easy to be too sedentary. John Steinbeck, who lived across the street from me on 72nd Street, had a tall desk and wrote everything standing. And every day. He looks like a sedentary writer.
Any other questions? Yes, sure. Got one in the back.
This is for both of you. How do you name your characters, and do you ever have a problem with a character you can see and feel, but just don't get the right name? And if you had that problem, how do you solve it? Do you ever use a phone book, or what do you do?
Well, my characters, I mean, in the case of The Castle in the Attic, it's a time travel book. So I needed a British royal name. So William made perfect sense to me. Grace, in Counting on Grace, comes from that period. There were many children named Grace. The title in that case took me forever to find. And it was, in the end, the perfect title, because Counting on Grace, there was a kind of a spiritual element to it, plus the mother counts on Grace to doff the frames as quickly she can, and in addition, Grace turns out to be very good at math, so she does counting for her family, so I had a three-way, so Grace was, but as far as, I think, if I don't have the right name for a character, the book doesn't move. Does not move.
Okay. Grace is coming back. Yeah. Yes, that's important. Also, we've written more than 100 books between this, and you go through a lot of names. and it's probably all right, but mostly out of print,
right.
But you don't want to do that again, because somebody will catch you. Okay. Is that the same character?
I was telling Randy earlier, I mean, I've written since 72. My first novel was published in 1974. Well, if I go out now and someone puts up their hand and says, now why did Jennifer do blankety blank? And I think, who the hell is Jennifer? And so I sort of say, tell me more. That's really
They think you can retain everything.
And they've just read the book.
Yes.
So somebody said, so it's totally alive for them. But
I have letters that say, what did you mean on page 49 without naming the book? And my favorite letter, our teacher told us to write for our favorite novel. Could you get me the address of Danielle Steele? Maybe I could.
talented will do.
Those are voices. And I keep a list of the names of the young people who write. So that way, I know in this novel there's a life joke about 9 Joshes in one class. And I got 6 letters from girls named Jessica once, so I named the novel and finished Portrait of Jessica. I'm a Midwestern writer, so I use my high school yearbook. And I use the Brooklyn phone book if I need a forum.
Or gravestones are useful if you're doing historical.
Yes.
Walking through a graveyard is very helpful.
Wow.
Note the date with that.
Yes.
I have 2 questions. One is for Richard. Do you think your book had an effect on the World Series this year?
Oh.
And given that, I think your publisher should send Theo Epstein and some of the leaders. And my serious question is, you talk so much about how you have to shed a lot of what you first write, or you have to consistently throw out what might have seemed to be. Did anything ever just come to you writing all this?
Yes.
Good?
Yes, in this book. For months I was putting words in their mouths, which is what you have to do. And 8 months later, a boy who is concerned about his uncle's romance that he's not pursuing well. This is highly unlikely for an 11-year-old boy to concern himself, but this is an uncle talking. So he says to his dad, who is concerned too, "Can we talk some sense into my uncle?" And he said, and the dad says, I didn't know he was going to say, "No. We'll talk about cars and liquors." I said, "Well, that didn't do good." And the dad says, "You work with watching." And I knew I had it all.
For me, a line like that. Now, the only book that came to me wholesale is a very young picture book called Shoes. And it just kept coming out. In fact, I sent it to the editor. They said, "We're going to publish it." And when they sent me back the galleys, I said, "You're missing a whole last page." And they said, "Oh, that must have fallen out of the envelope. We didn't need it." So, in Counting on Grace, Lewis Stein comes to spend the night at Grace's house, and she's very smart because she's charged him $1, and the mother normally charges 50 cents for visiting borders where they make some money. And he uses the basement as a darkroom. And he develops the picture. He's taken this picture. He's taken of Grace. And she says, "Who's that horrid old woman looking at herself?" And he says, "That's the face you see in the mirror every morning." Mm-hmm. And she says, "We don't got no mirror." Mm-hmm. And that just said, you know, that then you knew what you were.
There's a paradox in what you've both said, which is that you want to activate the people in your books, but you yourself have to be incredibly, unbelievably patient and, in fact, passive. How do you weather that? How do you, how do you make that transition? How do you be patient enough to put all that filler in for a novel? It seems
say that again in one sentence.
I don't know. You're saying that you need to get out of the book's way.
Yes.
But you need to live the book. And there's a lot, yeah. So it seems.
Okay. It's a process. And I was lucky. I never had a teacher who said, "Write what you know." Express yourself. Boys don't like that. Girls will tell you, boys won't. So I have no great urge to hear myself on the page, because I was a teacher. I know how long the students would listen to me and how long they would listen to each other.
that you have to, you of course have to polish and clean it up, but they are alive,
yep,
and living, and there's nothing like that book. We always search for it, and it start, every book doesn't teach you how to write all the other books. It only teaches you how to write that one. So you start every time at the beginning, waiting for that golden moment. So.
I have a question.
Oh, you have a question, yes.
Yes, for Christy. Can you tell me the last writing assignment the teacher gave your class?
The most recent writing assignment I had was actually challenge that I've overcome.
A challenge I have overcome. How did you feel about that assignment? Will you share with us what the challenge?
Dyslexia.
And maybe one day you will write about it.
We'll see.
I'm no position to give a contract. Thank you, Nicholas.
Are there any other questions? Yes.
Thank you both, Elizabeth and Richard. How do you circumvent, this is for both of you, how do you circumvent the problem of writing too close to the bone? Any relatives come and say, yes, I don't like the way you portrayed me in the book, would you please change it? Or they get angry about something. Has that ever come up? Maybe you have lovely relatives and they like you know.
I have an uncle who said every time Elizabeth writes a book, it's like dodging a bullet. For me right now, I'm right at the edge of that because I'm working on a memoir, and nobody's going to be happy.
That's territory.
Yeah.
Well, I never wrote a line of fiction until I was 37 years old, living in New York, 1,000 miles from my origins. And we never occurred to me to write anything about my own family because we're Middle Westerners. We don't tell you our secrets. Dirty laundry is never on the line, but reputation's on. So if that worked, then I found out later, they were all holding their
breath.
Because they seemed to think they were interesting enough for enough. That's why I was in New York.
I actually did have a family that was holding its breath and dodging bullets, but also could provide one with a great deal of fodder.
But I waited for them to be there.
Yeah, well, the new book I'm talking about, the title is The Children of Spies.
Yes.
So,
yes. We know who the spies are.
Yeah.
Would you care to say?
Well, my family, my father was a famous writer named Stuart Alsop, and I'm writing about growing up in Cold War Washington through a whole period of time with him. And during the J. Edgar Hoover and the Kennedys and so on. So there are a lot of secrets there that could be released. But I'm looking very much at the family secrets, not interested in the
and that's what people are more interested in.
I have one last question. How do you know when it's time to stop rewriting and revising and that the book is actually ready?
Well, as I told you, I got it all wrong in the book. I had no ending or titles. I'm not a good example.
So someone has to tell you.
Yes, I had to tell you.
I think in fact that's true. Although I wrote a novel called In My Mother's House, Results, and I had a whole last chapter that I just thought was going to be so brilliant. It was set in Connecticut, and in my grandmother's house in Connecticut, the Italian workers that my grandfather had brought over from Lake Garda to work the dairy farm, their grandchildren bought the farm and turned it into a golf course. And they called it Val Campo. And when my uncle went to hit the champagne across the sign, and the sign was revealed, he turned to Aldo Morelli and he said, "You spelled Campo wrong," because he took Italian in boarding school and it spelled Campo, C-A-M-P-O. And it says C-O-M-P-O. And Aldo looked at Uncle John and said, yeah, who cares? We're all Americans now. This is the perfect last chapter. Got to the penultimate chapter and thought, no, that whole scene doesn't belong. So it's just funny how the book tells you.
Any final questions?
Yes.
What do you do about writer's block? Well, there's a government agency that will help you. It's called the IRS. If you writing for a living is easier than writing for a grade. And I am allowed to hit my own deadlines. That doesn't solve everything, but I am now participating in the process. And my editor doesn't say, well, your deadline is March. She says, if you want on the fall list of 18, I'll read the manuscript in 30 days. Well, I do want it. You want it? I want it. Also, we're unemployed, aren't we? We get a lot done.
The other thing is, if you're stuck on one story, go over here and start another. It'll come back to it. I find I often need two or three things happening in my head. And if you get lost on one, you can often pick up another, or I write poetry.
That's good. Poetry clarifies.
And
because there's white space on the page.
Yeah, white space. And the final thing is what Ernest Hemingway said, which is never leave something in the middle. Don't ever leave something at the end of a chapter or the end of a paragraph. If I'm going away and I'm not going to write for the rest of the day and coming back the next day, it's the middle of a sentence. I started a sentence and I had a page. You get very quickly back into what you're writing.
Write at the same time?
Yeah. I go out for breakfast, and I write from about 9:30 to 1:30, and then I do other stuff in the afternoon, you know, loyalty problems, the travel. What about you, Richard? You know?
I don't know when I write. I don't know how I do it. It's harder now because people sending you a separate message for every piggling you take.
Oh, yes. I wrote The Mouse Who Lived in the White House. And I lived, you know, near the White House in Washington, D.C., and I left the manuscript. It was in a composition, you know, the speckled things that say composition 1824 and afterward. And I filled up every single line right to the end. I determined the plot, was it going to finish at the end. And I took it in to show it to my teacher, and I left it on the school bus. Never saw it again. So I decided I wanted to be a tennis player. And I turned out to be a better writer than a tennis player.
So I'm
back.
No, I didn't. I was doing homework. I was grubbing for grades. And they were hard to get.
Yeah.
And I needed a scholarship. By the time I'd done that, and we were writing everything. We wrote everything. Beautiful cursive.
Yeah.
That was the experience, but it wasn't like my what I was doing.
My father was a writer at home, and we always said he had a sign on his door. I have five brothers, there were six of us in the house. We always said he had a sign on his door that said, please don't knock unless you're bleeding. And that was sort of the idea. So I did come in the afternoon, and I heard the old Underwood typewriter piece, and I thought, well, you know, we've got a roof over our head, we have shoes, we can eat. And I once said to him, no, I think I'm going to be a writer because it's kind of easy. I almost had Underwood drop from my head.
I was wondering if there was a particular children's book you read, either of you, that inspired you to be children's book writers, or just any books in general that inspired you to write?
Yes, indeed. when I was in fourth grade in Dennis School in Decatur, Illinois, there was no library. There was Mrs. Cole, fourth grade teacher. And there were 43 of us in the class. It was swollen by World War II. And she never got up from her desk or anything. But one day she came up behind me on my line side and handed me a book and said, "Here, you might try this." That was the verb. Adults weren't very interested in what children liked to them, what they just want to be adults. It was The Adventures of Uncle Dirt. And I went home and tried it. I'm still trying it. When I saw what could happen on the page, in the middle of the United States, in a river I had seen, I was on my way. I arrived because I could read a 19th century novel cover to cover in fourth grade. Mm-hmm. Not because I was gifted, but because the teacher had complete authority in the question.
Is there a favorite?
My mother is British, and so I had a lot of British novels. I was exposed to a huge number of British novels. And they all, I honestly think it was The Borrowers. That whole concept. I didn't know I was going to be a children's book writer. I went to Sarah Lawrence College, where I was allowed to major in writing, which was the whole reason I went there. And I wrote short stories, and hundreds of terrible short stories, all about adults. I knew nothing about being an adult. And after I'd taken every course in 3 years of college, I finally took writing for children. And I thought, well, I'm already the only child, so I better write for children. And and then I went to work at Harper & Row. In the old days, I was an editor under Ursula Nordstrom. And I worked for Charles Jolotow and Shel Silverstein, walked in every day, or Arnold Bobel, and it was like, this is where I belong.
Well, thank you so much.